I'm Kirk Megu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hi, today my guest is Evan Smith, author of the new book, No Platform, A History of Anti-Fascism, Universities, and the Limits of Free Speech. It's published by Routledge this year in 2020. Welcome, Evan.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and well, I'm welcoming you here from Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean. It's about to be sundown here, a bright and sunny day. What's it like there in Australia? That's where you are, right?
Yes, I'm in Adelaide in South Australia, and it is a cold and rainy morning.
Okay, okay. Well, I'm still in Friday. Tell me what Saturday's like.
I can't see anything. It's too dark.
All right. Well, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background, particularly as it relates to this book?
Okay, so I am a research fellow at Flinders University in South Australia, and I've done a lot of work on political extremism and social movements previously. A lot of my work had been on the British left and the British far right, actually. And that's how I came into looking at this work. I'd previously written a book published by Brill and Haymarket the other year called British Communism and the Politics of Race. And that had a discussion of no platforming and the fight against the National Front in the 1970s. And that's what really drove my interest to do this research on the wider history of no platform.
All right. I'm trying to figure out from your accent, are you British? Are you a Brit in Australia or are you Australian?
No, I am Australian of British parents, and I lived in Manchester.
Okay, all right. So, so doing history of the British left or just British activist politics has some challenges in a way, because a lot of the history you're writing is not necessarily documented. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So how do you get around that?
So there's kind of 2 paths you can take. Is one thing is that there's a lot of like ephemera and left-wing publications and increasingly internal documents, or you can go the oral history route. But my research has always been based in kind of the publications and the ephemera of the British left. So my original work was on the Communist Party. Because they had dissolved in the 90s, they had deposited their internal archives in the People's History Museum in Manchester. And that's where my work really began. And with the kind of the nature of the British left, there's a lot of people that held on to their own kind of ephemera. And in the last 10 years, there's been like a push to digitize this and put it online. So I've been really helped by a various bunch of people who have been able to make this available online, and particularly writing British history from Australia. I can't always be consulting material firsthand, so I have relied heavily on other people to scan documents for me, to find various things in the archives, and that's one of the challenges. And it's a challenge that everyone is having now with coronavirus and having to do this kind of research remotely. And I think writing this book from Australia gave me a good kind of experience of what it's like to do research under these new conditions.
Yeah. I actually did my master's thesis on the left in Trinidad and Tobago, and I mean, I find it, you know, very fun and fascinating. Also, going through all the pamphlets and the little things you find here and there, and whatever. Yeah. So I can imagine, you know, the way you did your research there too. So let's see, the book and the central concept of your book is no platforming. So could you just define it for us, and also just why is it important to discuss?
Okay, so no platforming is both a policy and a tactic. So as a tactic, it is the idea that fascists and explicit racists should not be allowed to speak, organize, or disseminate their propaganda in public or semi-public places. And as a policy, the National Union of Students implemented a policy in 1974 saying that no platform will be given to racists and fascists on university campuses. So as a tactic, it had kind of been developed since the 1930s in the fight against fascists in Britain. And as a policy, it extends from the 1970s. It really gets the name of no platform in the 1970s, a few years prior to the National Union of Students policy, with the International Marxist Group, which was a Trotskyist group, coming up with the concept of no platform for racists. So that's what it is. It's both a distinct NUS policy, but it's also a wider kind of anti-fascist tactic. And it's important because it has long been portrayed as kind of shutting down free speech. In Britain, there is no kind of First Amendment, so there's no explicit right to free speech, but there's kind of a general principle of, you know, liberal democracy, and no platforming has been portrayed since it was introduced in the 1970s as kind of like an antithesis to free speech and to academic freedom. And it is important because in the last half decade, the tactic has really been controversial in this kind of current idea that there's a free speech crisis on campuses. And this is something that we see both in the UK and also across the English speaking world. So, you know, in North America, in Australia, in New Zealand, in South Africa, there's a lot of debate of whether free speech is being killed on campus and then also in kind of wider society.
Yeah, I mean, and the position you're basically taking in the book is a defense of no platforming, whereas usually people are, you know, attacking it or reluctantly explaining exceptions in a sense. Mm. So you are taking a different tack, correct?
Yes. So my book is an interventionist history. So really, the reason I wrote it was because the word gets bandied around a lot, no platform and so forth, but really it has a distinct history from both the kind of interwar period, but then the 1970s, and is that a lot of the contemporary kind of like media discussion and social media discussion had always kind of talked about it in a historical sense. So my book firstly was to kind of explain the history and what it was as a concept throughout its history. But it is also a defense of no platforming because it has been a tactic used by students and other activists to kind of fight racism, fascism, and then other forms of oppression. Like, so there'd been no platform of sexists, homophobes, and other kind of forms of hate speech. And that in the contemporary era, when we have a kind of a resurgent far right and a kind of the intermingling between the conservative right and the more populist right, and also kind of extreme rightism, is that no platform is used as a tactic to kind of deny these people the opportunity to spread their kind of hateful views. A lot of the work on no platform and kind of free speech on campus comes from a kind of this defense of free speech. But my book says that there has to be limits, particularly because free speech can't be divorced from other things happening in society.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's important that you make that argument and that defense, because usually people avoid it. Even if they might agree with it, they might say, I suppose they'll talk about hate speech. So I'd like to explore it a little. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the First Amendment in the United States, and yeah, when it's a US-based discussion, which a lot of this is in the English-speaking world, mm-hmm. They talk about the Constitution, but in England, in the Caribbean where I am, or in India, or in Canada, or in other places, Australia and whatnot, there is no First Amendment. Mm. So that's an interesting, different contextual position. But generally, it is seen that the cornerstone of liberal democracy is freedom, and the freedom of speech is seen as one of the primary enlightenment virtues of from the breaking away from the Catholic Church with the Protestants, and then then right up to the French Revolution, I suppose, and the secular liberal development there. So what would your argument be against that, mainstream view there?
So I think that a lot of the time is that freedom of speech is seen as being in a kind of like a vacuum, that obviously you have to weigh the freedom of speech with other freedoms. Like, even if we go back to kind of liberal philosophy, a lot of people bring up Mill and so forth, is that freedom of speech doesn't exist on its own. It has to, has to work within other freedoms. Other people should have freedom from discrimination, freedom from oppression, freedom from being a victim of hate speech, and that the freedom of speech, even in the First Amendment terms, is about freedom from government interference. It's not the right to a platform without dissent, without confrontation. So there's this idea that, freedom of speech is always completely desirable, so absolute freedom of speech, because it's always tempered with other freedoms. But also, in a practical sense, is that, as I mentioned in the book, is that particularly when there's a speaker at a university or in a public place, is that their freedom of speech is not the only thing they need to consider. There are multiple pieces of legislation which limit speech in ways. There's like anti-discrimination laws, there's anti-counterterrorism laws, there's public order laws, There's libel and defamation laws. So there's all these things which kind of have to be balanced when looking at freedom of speech.
Right. So now there are a couple of ways, and I'm really interested in the theoretical aspect. We will get to the history, which is the bulk of your book, tracing it from Oswald Mosley's days and to the Powell and the National Front, and that's very important and fascinating. But I do want to sort of discuss the theoretical aspects, because there are, I suppose, two types of arguments that talk about limits to free speech, and as you said, the balancing it off with other types of freedoms. Also, it doesn't mean there shouldn't be a right to no dissent or no confrontation. But now, and your history is that you are outlining here is full of, the communists, the Trotskyists, and so forth. Definitely, the classical Marxists scoff at bourgeois rights, right? Well, they would say freedom of speech is a bourgeois right, mm-hmm. and they would say that. I suppose if I use a kind of more contemporary term, they wouldn't use it themselves, but anti-liberal, right? So they, have no pretense of being liberal. They are not liberal. They are anti-liberal. Right, and they have a very well developed frontal critique of liberalism. Mm. Is that your particular position?
I'm very sympathetic to it. That I'm not a kind of like dyed in the wool Marxist. I see the limits of it, but the Marxist critique of liberal freedoms is, it's very kind of convincing, is that, that liberalism talks about these kind of ideal freedoms, but these exist as abstract notions which kind of overlook the material world in which they work in, and that when we talk about freedom of speech, we have to understand the structures, the economic, the political, the social structure, the legal structures in which freedom of speech works, and that if we have this idea that there is absolute freedom of speech and people should have freedom of speech, is that we understand the kind of the power imbalances with who actually has freedom of speech in Western capitalist society.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose one aspect where it gets very controversial is the question of violence. Mm-hmm. Antifa, for example, openly advocate violence, and they say, sometimes there are some people that say speech is violence, but then Antifa, I don't think necessarily take that position in general. It's more like, the society, there's structural violence, and so this is more kind of like direct action violence. It's kind of more of an anarchist, drawing on an anarchist tradition there. And certainly in the history that you outline, and we'll discuss further, especially with Mosley and the British Union of Fascists and the communist clashes, the street brawls were a very big part of that. What is your view about violence in terms of no platforming?
So a militant anti-fascist argument would be that fascists and racists deal in violence, is that the aim of fascism and the aim of racism is to deny the rights of some people, and that they will use violence to do this, particularly when looking at explicit fascist groups is that they advocate for violence. And that militant anti-fascists would argue that in order to combat fascism and its violent rhetoric and its violent actions, is that you need to use violence and self-defense. So that a lot of the groups are involved in kind of no platforming, but not all of them would argue that you need to take this kind of direct action line, and this may spill into violence, but violence is not a desirable, but it is seen as something which may need to occur. Since no platforming has become National Unity Students' policy, it has been more about trying to prevent kind of disorder and violence from occurring by having a policy of saying we won't allow these people to come on campus. So trying to kind of like a bureaucratic stop valve before the violence occurs. So that was one of the things which I describe in the book, is that in the years leading up to the NUS policy in the 1970s, there have been a series of incidents where students have taken it upon themselves to disrupt speakers. So they disrupt Enoch Powell, the right-wing politician. They disrupt Hans Eysenck, who was a psychologist with very kind of racialized views, and disrupt other people. And this had involved violence, particularly a small group of Maoists at the London School of Economics in 1973 violently removed Hans Eysenck from a stage when he was trying to give a talk. And the NUS policy, which comes out in 1974, is kind of a way to say, if we have this policy, then it will try to kind of stop these confrontations, because fascists and racists and those kind of people will be barred from being invited onto campus in the first place. So it's kind of like a way to avoid those direct actions. But as soon as the NUS policy was introduced, we have kind of students, confronting speakers, and that does involve confrontation and then instances of disorder and instances of violence. But the kind of militant anti-fascist position would be that violence is not desirable, but it might be necessary, because fascists want to inflict violence, and you may need to use violence to protect yourself and the wider community.
And what do you think of the slippery slope argument? Because one of the problems is that the definition of fascism or racism can be very elastic and wide. And so, so someone like Alexander Dugin, for example, mm-hmm. Is sometimes called a fascist. He would deny it. And in his book, Platonism, he talks, that the Western tradition, Plato, Aristotle, they weren't democratic. They didn't have a particular, they weren't liberal. They weren't democratic. The majority of the Western tradition is not liberal, democratic. And so are they all fascist? Are they all racist? There's a whole debate right now about, tearing down, what monuments should be torn down, how do we deal with certain historical figures? When consequences, come for people, losing their jobs and maybe they might say an offensive comment or whatever, but does that make them a fascist or a racist that deserves utter condemnation and exile? So the whole slippery slope argument, I suppose, starts off with the fact that the who defines these things and the consequences? What's your view about those types of arguments?
Yeah. So the slippery slope argument kind of is that it expects that there's kind of that there's definitions that are kind of like not contested at the time. So I think that one of the things is that what we see in the history of no platforming is that these concepts of who is offensive, who should be confronted, who should be denied a platform, are contested at the grassroots level throughout this period where they've had NUS policy and throughout the kind of era as a tactic, is that that people are always kind of negotiating who is a fascist, what does fascism mean, what is racism, is no platforming or kind of the denial of a platform the tactic to be used at this time, what is the way to go about it. I think the slippery slope argument kind of hasn't really come off, that for all this kind of these grey areas, like say Amber Rudd, the former Home Secretary, being denied a platform at the University of Oxford just before shutdown, that these instances are in the minority, that most of the times when no platforming is used, it is against kind of the far right, it is against people who are kind of outright people with kind of the condemnable views. And I think that no platform also kind of needs to be disassociated from a wider thing, which people, you know, call cancel culture now. And mm-hmm. that no platforming is about a denial of a public or semi-public space. I think it acts in a similar world, but it can't be totally lumped in with kind of calls for people to be fired from their jobs, or that they'd be shut down on social media platforms and so forth like that. It kind of works on the same kind of principles, but no platform is a kind of a distinct tactic. And in my work, it is a distinct tactic within universities and colleges. But I understand, and I talk about it a little bit in the book about how it's linked to discussions about should racists and fascists and also the kind of sexist homophobes and transphobes, should they be given media platforms, or should there be interventions to shut down their social media presence and stuff like that. But I think that those are separate arguments which are linked, but I think they don't all fall under no platforming.
Right. Although, you know, I mean, the slippery slope argument, sort of, we're seeing it in the kind of, in feminist circles, the movement against TERFs and, you know, and people like Germaine Greer or, you know, feminist stalwarts who are now being seen as, you know, reactionary and, they're not being called fascist or racist, but transphobic, right? And platforming transphobic people. What's your view on that? That's part of, I suppose, the messy negotiation and democracy on defining what is offensive and what is not, or what is permissible and what is not.
Yeah, so I think that one of the things, and this is where a lot of the controversy is around nowadays, and when my research started properly on this topic was around since Jermaine Greer, there were calls for her not to be given a platform at Cardiff University because of her views on trans people. And I think that Sarah Ahmed, in her work, has really kind of done the kind of the groundwork for this, is that she says that when you give a platform to anti-trans people, it is about negotiating. It seems that people's existence is up for debate. That we normally wouldn't give a platform to people who said that people of different races or ethnicities should not exist or should be limited in some way in their existence. We wouldn't give a platform to people who say that women or gay people or bisexual people should have their existence or that their they're living kind of limited in some way, and that the same would be for trans people, is that when we debate with anti-trans people, with transphobic people, with gender-critical people, is that that kind of suggests that the existence, the rights of trans people is something that can be debated, and that Sarah Ahmed says this is kind of a chipping away at the rights of trans people to live their lives. And that in the same way that we don't debate with racists and we shouldn't debate with fascists and with kind of hard homophobes and stuff like that, is that we shouldn't give credence to transphobic views. And that this is where the controversy has come, is that, you know, What is transphobia, and do they kind of use that the same kind of language and rhetoric and kind of tactics as kind of other groups that have been no platformed and other kind of speakers? Is that, should they be applied to that? And this is an ongoing debate, but part of this ongoing debate is kind of understanding the history of no platform and how it has been used in the past. And one of my book is kind of a suggestion is that there's that while a lot of people have said that there's no platform in the 1970s and 80s, and that was against one thing, and now it's being completely used in a different context nowadays, is that my book is about, well, it has been a tactic which has been negotiated and contested over 40 years and has been applied in different ways. So it's not this kind of epistemological break that happens, that's happened sometime in the last 10, 15 years, where woke in inverted commas students have just decided to shut down everybody that they find offensive. That this has been something which has kind of ebbed and flowed since the 1970s.
Right. And I suppose the last sort of theoretical question, which gets into the history, the kind of theoretical challenging question, I suppose, mm-hmm. Is that, a lot of the arguments that that's used by the left in no platforming, or let's say, you know, the Trotskyist communists or the hard left, let's say, sometimes, you know, the exact same principles are espoused by the right to shut down the left. Talking about limits to freedoms and balancing against other freedoms. You know, I remember when, you know, communists and socialists were, you know, just persona non grata, in American campuses and stuff like that, and on American TV, you know, it would be if you were a communist, that would just, you know, you would not even be entertained or allowed, unlike, you know, Britain, for example. And then, you know, more in the 90s, I suppose it was in the 80s, but like 90s, 2000s and whatnot, people would use that argument about, you know, the limits of tolerance for Islam, right? You know, well, you know, we shouldn't be tolerant towards Islam because of, you know, their position on women or homosexuals or whatnot. And then even, I suppose, like in the 70s, from before, but in Britain in the 70s, like with the IRA, for example, you know, Paul McCartney's song was banned, you know, because it, you know, any reference to the IRA, you know, was seen as promoting violence. So I guess it's another aspect of the slippery slope thing that it can actually be turned around against the left, and it has been in the past. Do you have any comment on that?
So, I mean, one thing is that people in the center talk about, you know, that the tactics and the rhetoric of the far left and the far right are the same. But I think one of the things to kind of what is the end goal of each? So what is the goal of the far right is to have a discriminatory, authoritarian society where some people have rights and some people do not have rights, where a lot of people don't have rights, where there is the kind of no kind of freedoms for many people. But the left is about, you know, it's not about that. It's about trying to make an improved society for everybody. So I think that kind of like that in the center, if you're equating the far left and the far right, is that this idea that you know, that we should treat the left and the right in the same way, or is that what is the end goal of both of those? What happens if you give the same credence to the right and the left? And that many people would argue that you see an ascendant far right, you see an ascendant discriminatory system. You know, that the resurgence of the right nowadays, you know, Trump, the populist right across continental Europe, hard right governments in Britain, in Australia, and so forth, is that it's because the center has tried to give the same weight to the right and the left, and seen both as kind of adversary enemies, and that has allowed the right to kind of to pick up the pace. I think with kind of other issues, so with other things of, like other examples of who else has been denied freedom of speech and so forth like that, is that in my work on No Platform, there are times when people push for different groups. So in the 1990s, Islamic fundamentalists, particularly Hizb ut-Tahrir, is banned from campuses, and the NUS policy now, that there are six groups banned at the kind of national level, not at the individual student level. So the NUS, No Platforms like the British National Party, English Defence League, National Action, but also Hizb ut-Tahrir and other kind of Islamic fundamentalist groups.
Louis Farrakhan is banned as well. Is the Nation of Islam as an organization, or is it just him as an individual?
I think that is, so that's not intertwined. That's not actually kind of explicit in the NUS policy at national level, but I think that would be something that you would see at individual student levels, is that Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam would be banned, would be kind of no platformed by individual student unions. And I think that was the case. This is something that one of the few cases that I didn't look at was Farrakhan being banned from campuses in Britain I think in the 90s, but there is kind of that weight given by the NUS to both Islamic fundamentalism and the far right as both of kind of things that are beyond the pale and should not be given a platform.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to the to the heart of your book. We've had a nice sort of discussion about some of the thornier aspects of it, but the main argument of your book is, as you've said in our discussion so far, is that no platforming is not a new thing. It's not an aberration. It's part of a long tradition. And you started with Oswald Mosley. Is that correct?
Yes.
Perhaps there are some readers, some listeners who may not be familiar with Mosley and his movement. Mm-hmm. Why don't you give a little background to that?
Okay, so Oswald Mosley was a British politician, and then in the 1930s, he began the British Union of Fascists, and then later the British Union of Fascists and National Socialists. And he was, during the Depression, he became more interested in fascism in Italy and kind of the pitfalls of liberal democracy.
So he was contemporaneous with Mussolini, Hitler.
And that he is probably the best known kind of English speaking fascist figure across the world. Like that, he modeled his party very much along the lines of Mussolini, to a lesser extent. Kind of the Nazis, but very based on Mussolini's fascists. And from the very beginning, that there was an anti-fascist movement in Britain, which said that we can't give ground to Mosley, we can't give ground to the BUF, that they need to be confronted. So the British Union of Fascists comes around in 32, 33, so just as the Nazis ascend to power in Germany, and the communists, as well as kind of like trade unionists, parts of the Labour Party, are pointing to Germany and saying, this is what happens when you don't confront fascism in its infancy, that if you allow fascism to develop, to grow, then you'll end up with what we see in continental Europe.
If you don't mind me just interjecting here, I was unfamiliar with Mosley until when I was doing my PhD in the UK. Channel 4 had a documentary on Mosley, and it was fascinating. And I mean, and he was really a very charismatic figure, and you could see how he could attract a lot of people toward him, the danger was in that respect that he was, and that whole the kind of debates between the liberal free speech, so do you let him speak, and he's effective, he was able to gather large crowds, or the communists were the real sort of opposition. It's the kind of same divisions today that we were seeing then and that you outlined in your book, correct?
So I think that one thing is that yes, Mosley was a very charismatic speaker, and this happens even after his kind of political career is over. He is then invited, as I show in the book, to speak at universities and to speak other places because he was seen as such an eloquent speaker. But the communists and the kind of anti-fascists said that that's only one part of him and his movement, is that there is a violence underpinning it. And they show from very early on is that that while Mosley is speaking, he is flanked by bodyguards who are willing to use violence to break up who put down dissent. So there's a famous incident at Olympia, which was a venue in London. And in 1934, communists and other anti-fascists attempt to disrupt Mosley from speaking, and they are dealt with violently by bodyguards and turfed out onto the street and beaten up in the streets by Mosley's bodyguards. And then there's a lot of arrests of anti-fascists. And so what the anti-fascists in the 1930s are trying to say is that while Mosley, you know, kind of has the kind of the oratory skills of a politician, is that his movement is embedded in violence, and that we shouldn't allow him freedom of speech because he wants to deny it to others.
Right. And then I suppose the next huge figure after Mosley in Britain is, you know, Powell. And then the National Front, which, I mean, Enoch Powell wasn't a leader of the National Front. You know, he was a conservative politician, but not. But you know, there was a synergy sort of between them. And then the '80s, and then later the BNP. And yeah, so why don't you take us through that part of the history as well?
Okay, so after the Second World War, Mosley's group is kind of banned. So the British Union of Fascists is banned. And then we see Mosley and other kind of fascists rebuilding, but they are kind of limited, but the political space offered to them. But Enoch Powell, he was a conservative politician. He was a minister in the conservative government. In 1964, he was the Minister of Health. And then when in opposition, he becomes a more and more vocal critic of immigration from the Commonwealth to Britain. And in 1968, he makes a famous speech, which is often called the Rivers of Blood speech, where he kind of calls for an end to immigration from the Commonwealth to Britain, because he believes that that one day white people will be on the receiving end of oppression from kind of non-white migrants. And this kind of, it excites both the kind of the hard right of the Conservative Party. So things like the Monday Club, which was kind of like a pro-empire, anti-immigration group within the Conservatives, but it also excites the extreme right. So the National Front was a fascist organization which had been established in 1967. And in 1968, when Powell speaks, they had their first kind of influx of members. And while Powell is kicked out of the Conservative Party, he's kicked out of the ministry and the kind of any, and he's made a backbencher. That while he is he's still a Tory MP but a backbencher, he kind of occupies this space, which is kind of the hard right opposition to kind of mainstream conservatism, but also he is not a member of a fascist organization. So he acts as this kind of populist right wing kind of lightning rod for dissent. And that he has a symbiotic relationship with kind of these other groups. So like there's Powell, there's the Monday Club, and then there's the National Front. And they kind of all work within this kind of anti-immigrationist space, which is then where we see where no platform is developed in this time, when there is a kind of a far right milieu growing,
right? And that's 1974 when the NSU.
So the National Union Students in April 1974 comes up with the policy of no platform, which had been pushed by the Trotskyist groups over the last couple of years. So 1972, there was the Ugandan Asian controversy. So Idi Amin in Uganda was looking to Africanize his country and kick out a lot of the Asian population, which had come during the time of British rule. And a lot of them still had British passports, so they come to Britain. Between 50 and 100,000 come over the space of a couple of years. And this is really used by PAL, but also the National Front, to kind of like bolster their kind of their rhetoric. The National Front have kind of some kind of electoral, not success, but they start making inroads at by-elections and local elections. So in 1973, they get 16% of the vote in a by-election of West Bromwich in the Midlands. And this kind of worries the kind of anti-fascist, is that what is happening is the National Front growing in electoral strength, in strength of membership, and so forth, and this worries a lot of people across the board, including the student movement.
Right, and now the expansion of no platforming in the 80s. You speak about that in the book as well. If you could just give us a little bit of an idea of that dynamic.
Yeah, so the original NUS policy is directed at national level. So it's kind of like a blanket policy that student unions should deny a platform to fascists and racists. But after the National Front kind of wavers in the 1980s, so kind of there's a large anti-fascist movement in the 1970s, and that it kind of, the National Front falls apart when Thatcher is elected. But individual student unions take no platforming to say that the National Front is not the only problem. So one thing is that it is used against hard right politicians. So one thing is that under the Thatcher government, there's a kind of like a quite right wing conservative government, and that certain politicians within the Conservative Party are seen as kind of like they should not be allowed to speak. Particularly, they point out people like Timothy Raisin, who was immigration minister at a time when there's a lot of immigration controversy, that there was kind of accusations of racial discrimination within the immigration system, or backbenchers like John Carlisle, who was a Tory MP, who was also a kind of pro-South Africa. And then people who were members of the Monday Club, like Harvey Proctor, and kind of like, so the kind of the hardline anti-immigrationist Tory MPs, there was a lot of confrontation that students wanted to push to deny access to them. But there's also pushes that there's other forms of oppression in society. So sexism and homophobia are just as bad as racism. So there's pushes throughout the 1980s that there should be no platform for sexists. So this becomes student union policy at LSE in the early 1980s, and that is overturned, and there's kind of like a fight within the student union over the next couple of years about whether the no platform should exist as an official policy of the student union, but also that students argue that it should be extended to anti-abortionists, because anti-abortionism is a form of sexism. So in the mid-1980s, there is an anti-abortion activist named Victoria Gillick, and several student unions use the kind of principle of no platform to deny her a platform, but also then when she is allowed to speak, that some students use no platform as a tactic to kind of disrupt her from speaking. So at places like University of Sheffield and University of Manchester, that they kind of disrupt her speeches under this guise of no platforming sexists. And then there's also no platforming of homophobes. So in Swansea in 1987, a conservative councillor who was very vocal in his demonization of gay people and their link and kind of the demonization of AIDS, that the students sought to no platform him for his kind of homophobic views. So my book is kind of traces that since the policy was created in the 1970s, there were people who were saying, well, why should it just be extended to explicit fascists and explicit racists? There are other forms of oppression in society, that their views and their actions impact greatly upon different kinds of people, and should they be allowed to speak? If we deny a platform to racists and fascists, why shouldn't we deny a platform to pro-apartheid people, to homophobes, to sexists, to anti-abortionists?
Right, right. Now, you know, one thing, you know, going through the history that you've outlined there is two things stand out to me. One is the centrality, it seems, of communists and particularly Trotskyists, you know, as opposed to liberals. And so it's that, I suppose, division within what might one might call the left, right, between the communists and Trotskyists and the liberals. So that's one thing that stands out. And another thing that stands out, especially from the Mosley days, is the violence. So the violence that we are seeing today sometimes is certainly not new when you look at it in a historical perspective. Those are two things that really stood out to me. Do you have any sort of comments you want to make on that?
Yeah, so yes, original no platforming is kind of heavily supported by the hard left, by the far left, so groups like the Communist Party and the various Trotskyist groups. But actually, it's interesting that in the 1980s, the Trotskyist groups are actually opposed to expanding no platform as a tactic. So when other groups,
it's kind of like the Marxist versus post-Marxist debate.
So they're saying that no platform has a particular function in anti-fascism. It can't be used as a blanket kind of tactic. And they kind of like, they argue against no platform. And so kind of the Socialist Workers' Party, who were kind of largely involved in the anti-fascist movement in the 1970s, they kind of say, no, we need to use other forms of activism against sexist, homophobes, and pro-apartheid people, that they can't be no-platformed in the same way that we'll no-platform the National Front. But the thing is, the momentum is taken away just from the Trotskyists. Some feminists, some kind of black students and Asian students and kind of anti-apartheid activists, they say, why should there be kind of different, why should we just use kind of tactics to confront fascism and racism? Is that there are other forms of oppression which need to be confronted. So that in the 1980s, as you see the kind of the resistance is disorganized. You know, it's not a particular group arguing no platform should be expanded. It is kind of like individual students and kind of these kind of ad hoc groups which kind of push for the no platforming to be expanded as a tactic and as a policy. It's a lot of it is directed by feminists, by gay rights activists, by Black and Asian activists, students who say that, you know, that the things need to be confronted in a way that the kind of the organized left, so the Socialist Workers Party or the Communist Party, are unwilling to do. So it is not just the liberals, like kind of the liberal center versus the left, but there's also divisions within the left of how to approach these problems.
And thinking in an American context now, the sort of parallel American experience, I suppose, especially with the BLM and Antifa, sort of, I don't know if to call it an alliance or whatever, but with the protests going on right now, I mean, Antifa are certainly taking a lead in the violence, and there seems to be a division between Black Lives Matter and Antifa, at least at some levels. So that's an interesting ideological split that manifests itself, you know, in the real world in that way.
Yeah, and I think that one thing we need to understand is that when we talk about anti-fascism and nowadays we talk about Antifa, is that Antifa is not an organization. It is a movement, and it is a series of intersecting interests within it. So there's anarchists, there's Trotskyists, there's communists, and there's other kind of like just militant anti-fascists who have different approaches to things like violence, to protests, to organizing, and then also how they see the state, capitalism, the right, and to the idea, and to the issues of Black Lives Matters and racism and so forth like that. So we can't even talk about Antifa as kind of like as something coherent, because it is actually a series of intersecting interests. And I think that you also see this in my book in the 1980s, that so the confrontations, the anarchists are fighting with the Trotskyists and then fighting with kind of other student activists over what is the approach to take. Is that should there be a disruption, should there be a picket, or should there be kind of like kind of a vigil or something, or some kind of bureaucratic measure? What is the best way to try and limit the space afforded to these kind of racist voices?
Yeah, interesting. So if, as we, you know, wrap up the interview here, where do you see this no platforming tactic and strategy going? Your book is very much an intervention in a debate. I would say. So how do you see the dynamic going now?
I think that the book really ends on that no platform has existed for the last 40 years as kind of a policy and as a tactic, because the threats which no platform confronts haven't gone away. They have mutated, they've shifted, they've changed, but they haven't gone away. And I think that in an era when we see kind of an ascendant far right, an ascendant populist right, and kind of the problems we face today, is that I don't think no platforming is going to go away, because the reasons why it is used as a tactic and as a policy, that the things that it's reacting against are still here. I think that in an age of social media and kind of like the internet, there are different ways in which it can influence kind of activism. So there's a major push nowadays to deplatform fascists and racists from a kind of social media, and to use and from using the internet. So there's a latest push for Visa to not allow payments to far right groups. And there's kind of like these kind of campaigns that should Facebook, should Twitter, should various other platforms allow fascists and racists to organize on them and to use them. And I think that that's a way in which no platform is kind of developing into interlinked but yet separate spheres of discussion. So there's the idea of like, you know, should social media, should we be deplatforming people on social media and from the internet? Should mainstream media, should like television and radio, particularly television, should they be allowing far right voices? So, in the UK, Nigel Farage, who was the leader of UKIP and then was the leader of Brexit Party, you know, that he has just been axed as a radio presenter. There are pushes that Nigel Farage shouldn't be given kind of television airtime. People like Tommy Robinson, who helped set up the English Defence League, is that there's, you know, pushes that Question Time shouldn't allow him a platform to air his views. So the way that no platform has existed within kind of the sphere of the university and higher education, it spills out into these other spheres. And I think that while the far right and kind of these forces of oppression still exist, is that I don't think no platform will go away because the problems it was created to confront are still there.
Right. Well, after reading this book, what message would you like to leave your readers with?
So that I came up with a couple of things in the conclusion to my book that I wanted to kind of highlight. One thing is that fascism didn't go away in 1945, and is that fascism still exists and the far right still exists as a threat, and that we need to be vigilant against this, and we need to recognize that while the far right has shifted and fascism has shifted, it still exists and still needs to be confronted. Free speech does not exist in a bubble. That free speech is often talked about as an abstract concept, but it has very real-world applications. And is that should we be giving platforms to the far right and to other people who indulge in hate speech? And what is the practical outcomes of providing these kind of people with these platforms? That while we can't really control students and academics and people who are in the higher education can't really affect the program decisions of kind of news networks and so forth, is that we can have a say in who is allowed to speak on campus, who is allowed to use the university to disseminate their ideas, and that when we say that, free speech, what is the practical outcomes of this free speech if people decide to give a platform to the right, to the hard right, to the far right, where does that end up? So I think that, I think that's the purpose of the book, is to say that the threat still exists, and that if these kind of people are given platforms, is that what can happen, and what can we do to limit their influence, limit their reach, limit their appeal, and no platforming is part of breaking down the threat of the far right today.
All right. Okay, well, thanks so much for this interview. I mean, it's been very informative and interesting.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Once again, the book is No Platform, A History of Anti-Fascism, Universities, and the Limits of Free Speech. And we've been speaking to the author, Evan Smith. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.